becomes meaningless as a limit on congressional power or on government power in general. In a similar vein, an article in the New Republic titled Hyperactive, How the Right Learned to Love Judicial Activism, claimed that conservative judges have turned themselves into the mirror image of the judicial activists whom they have spent their careers attacking. Using this new redefinition of judicial activism, a New York Times writer charged Chief Justice John Roberts with sometimes supporting judicial action, even if it meant trampling on Congress and the states. A later New York Times editorial declared a willingness to strike down congressional laws to be the most common objective criteria of judicial activism. This redefinition sidesteps the whole crucial question whether the laws overruled were in fact consistent or inconsistent with the Constitution of the United States. But this key issue is repeatedly left out of claims that the Supreme Court is activist when it fails to uphold legislation or particular precedents. The new definition of judicial activism lends itself to a purely numerical basis for deciding who is and who is not a judicial activist. Professor Sunstein, for example, basing his charges on how many federal laws per year the Supreme Court has declared unconstitutional. That notion has spread from the intelligentsia into politics. Thus, Senator Patrick Leahy used this new definition of judicial activism when he asserted, "The two most activist judges we have right now are Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia, who have struck down and thus written laws of their own in place of congressional laws more than anybody else on the current Supreme Court." Since these are the two justices most identified with judicial restraint, it was a verbal coup to turn the tables and label them conservative activists. Blurring the line between judicial activism and judicial restraint not only diffuses criticism of liberal activist judges, but enables points to be scored by invoking moral equivalence against judicially restrained judges who can also be called activist by simply redefining the term. Genuine judicial activism, like many other social phenomena, may be more readily understood by examining the incentives and constraints facing those involved. One constraint on judges' actions that has clearly weakened over the years is the disapproval of peers, whether in the judiciary or among legal scholars in the law schools. Judicial activism for litigants or causes favored by the prevailing vision of the intellectuals can expect acceptance, at a minimum, and in many cases celebration or lionizing of activist judges. In short, incentives favor judicial activism. Judges, like intellectuals, usually become famous among the general public only when they step out beyond the bounds of their professional competence to become philosopher kings, deciding social, economic, or political issues. Not even Chief Justice Earl Warren's admirers tried to portray him as a great legal scholar. Both he and Chief Justice Roger Taney a century earlier became famous for making sweeping pronouncements about society on a sociological rather than a legal basis for their landmark rulings, with pronouncements going beyond the range of their expertise or competence being virtually a prerequisite for popular prominence. It is hardly surprising that so many judges, like so many intellectuals, have said so many things that make no sense. Judicial restraint and original intent. Judicial restraint has sometimes been summed up in another idiomatic expression, namely following the original intent of the law. Many among the intelligentsia have seized upon the word intent to claim that it is difficult or impossible to discern exactly what those who wrote the Constitution, or legislation for that matter, actually intended, especially after the passing of many years. Thus, Professor Jack Rakove of Stanford University said, "Establishing the intention behind any action is a tricky business, and the task grows geometrically more complex when we try to ascribe intent to groups of people, especially men who were acting 2 centuries ago, who left us incomplete records of their motives and concerns, and who reached their decisions through a process that fused principled debate with hard-driven bargains." The key word in all of this, and the key fallacy in this common line of reasoning, is the word behind. Practitioners of judicial restraint are seeking to understand and apply the written law as it stands, as instructions for both judges and the citizenry, not discover the motivations, beliefs, hopes, or fears that might have been behind the writing of the law. Judicial restraint means undertaking an inherently less complicated task. Even the simplest law, such as a 65 miles an hour speed limit, can be expanded into a complex question of unanswerable dimensions if looked at in terms of the attitudes, values, etc., behind the intentions of those who created that law, rather than being looked at as an explicit instruction readily understood. Looking at laws in terms of the subjective intentions of those who wrote them is not only a more complicated approach, it is an approach that seeks or claims to discern the value judgments or the spirit behind the laws, which gives judges far greater latitude for interpretation and thus far more opportunities to adjust the laws to meet the needs of the time, social justice, or whatever other synonym for the individual predilections of particular judges. But critics of judicial restraint project such difficulties onto others who are not looking behind laws, but undertaking a far more straightforward task of reading laws as explicit instructions, rather than as general statements of values. As Justice Antonin Scalia put it, "Despite frequent statements to the contrary, we do not really look for subjective legislative intent." What he is seeking is the original meaning of the text, adding, "Often, indeed I dare say usually, that is easy to discern and simple to apply." Nor is Justice Scalia unique in this. From William Blackstone in 18th century England to Oliver Wendell Holmes and Robert Bork in 20th century America, those seeking to stick to the original meaning of laws have made it very clear that they were not talking about events taking place within the inner recesses of the minds of those who write laws. For one thing, the votes which provide the political, legal, and moral authority of laws are votes on what is publicly set before those who vote. In other words, nobody voted on what was in the back of somebody else's mind. Moreover, nobody can obey or disobey what is in the back of somebody else's mind. It was the publicly known meaning of the words of the laws to be understood in their usual and most known signification, as of the time they were used, according to Blackstone, that determines how a judge should interpret them. For Holmes as well, legal interpretation of what the lawmaker said did not mean trying to get into his mind. Holmes said, "We do not inquire what the legislature meant. We ask only what the statute means." In a letter to British jurist Sir Frederick Pollock, Holmes said, "We don't care a damn for the meaning of the writer." The judge's job, according to Holmes, is to read English intelligently, and a consideration of consequences comes into play, if at all, only when the meaning of the words used is open to reasonable doubt. Judge Robert H. Bork has likewise argued that judges should render decisions according to the historical constitution. Despite such plain statements by advocates and practitioners of judicial restraint over a long span of years, much verbal virtuosity has been deployed by others to expand the task to unachievable dimensions by turning the question into one of discerning subjective motives, beliefs, hopes, and fears behind the creation of the law. Professor Rakove, for example, said at the time of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, James Madison approached the convention in the grip of a great intellectual passion, that he had fear of certain policies regarding property and religion, and that he privately described constitutional amendments in a particular way. Similarly, Professor Ronald Dworkin has argued at considerable length against original intent on grounds that the mental events in the minds of legislators or writers of the Constitution are difficult or impossible to discern, that it seems even plainer that we have no fixed concept of a group intention, nor any way of deciding which aspects of individual mental states are relevant to a group intention. Justice William J. Brennan likewise spoke of the sparse or ambiguous evidence of the original intention of the framers of the Constitution. In a similar vein, others point out that public statements often do not reflect actual intentions. Such attempts to change the question from the plain meaning of a law to an esoteric quest for discovering what was behind the creation of the law are often used by those who espouse judicial interpretations that go beyond what the law explicitly says, and sometimes even directly counter to the written law, as Justice William J. Brennan did in the Weber case. Professor Ronald Dworkin defended the Weber decision on grounds that the question of how Title VII should be interpreted cannot be answered simply by staring at the words Congress used. The verbal virtuosity of referring to simply staring at words, apparently as the only alternative to adventurous reinterpretations, contrasts sharply with Holmes' statement about simply reading English intelligently. To Dworkin, the significance of the Weber decision was that it was another step in the court's efforts to develop a new conception of what equality requires in the search for racial justice. Why judges are to preempt such decisions and rule on the basis of their own new conceptions of social issues under the guise of interpreting the law while going directly counter to what the law says was a question not raised, much less answered. Saying that it is hard or impossible to discern what was meant by a law has often been a prelude to making decisions that ignore even the plainest meanings, as in the Weber case, in order to impose notions currently in vogue in elite circles as the law of the land. Dworkin and others have openly advocated as much, which makes their tactical agnosticism about intent a red herring. For those who do not intend to follow the original meaning of laws, the ease or difficulty of discovering that meaning is irrelevant, except as a distracting talking point. The Constitution was a very plainly written document, and when it used phrases like an establishment of religion, for example, it referred to something well known to people who had already lived under an established church, the Church of England. The prohibition against an establishment of religion had nothing to do with a wall of separation between church and state, which appears nowhere in the Constitution, but was a phrase from Thomas Jefferson, who was not even in the country when the Constitution was written. There was nothing esoteric about the phrase an establishment of religion, for more than 100 years after the Constitution was written, it never meant that it was illegal to display religious symbols on government property, however much some people in later times might wish that this was what it meant, and however much some modern judges might be willing to accommodate that wish. Similarly, with phrases like due process or freedom of speech, which had a long history in British law before those same phrases were placed in the Constitution of the United States by people who had only recently ceased to be British subjects, they were not coining new phrases for new or esoteric concepts whose meanings judges would have to divine de novo. Judicial restraint involves not only upholding constitutional provisions and the provisions of legislation that are within the authority of Congress or the states. It also involves a reluctance to overrule prior court decisions. Without such a reluctance, laws could become so changeable with the changing personnel of courts that citizens would find it difficult to plan economic or other endeavors that take time to come to fruition, for it would be impossible to predict what the turnover of judges and their changing of laws would be in the meantime. Needless to say, this reluctance to overturn prior court decisions cannot be absolute, but must be a matter of cautious judgment. If some legal scholar today should publish an article or book showing convincingly that Marbury v. Madison was wrongly decided in 1803, no court today would be likely to overrule that decision, on which 2 centuries of precedents have been built, and under which all sorts of endeavors and commitments have been undertaken during those centuries, relying on the legal system that evolved in the wake of Marbury v. Madison. Yet, ironically, many of the same intellectuals who heartily supported the Warren Court's overturning of long-standing precedents during the 1950s and 1960s also bitterly condemned later and more conservative courts, which cut back on some of the precedents established by liberal justices, especially in decisions during the Warren Court era. Thus, under the headline, "The High Court Loses Restraint," a New York Times editorial reacted to the Lopez decision by saying, "In deciding that Congress lacks the power to outlaw gun possession within 1,000 feet of a school, the Supreme Court has taken an unfortunate historical turn and needlessly questioned previously settled law." Citing Justice Stephen Breyer, the Times emphasized the value of judicial restraint, defined by them as deferring to Congress when Congress showed a rational basis for finding an interstate commercial impact in its law. But to defer to those whose powers the Constitution specifically limited would be to make a mockery of those limitations. If Congress itself is to decide how far its powers extend, what purpose can there be in constitutional limitations on the power of Congress or of the federal government? Inconsistent as such reactions from the intelligentsia have been, when viewed as commentary on jurisprudence, these reactions are perfectly consistent when viewed as part of a results-oriented role for courts, since the intelligentsia clearly preferred the social results of the Warren Court's decisions to the social results of many decisions of later courts. But court decisions based on the social results preferred by judges, rather than on the law as written, have a number of adverse effects on law as a fundamental framework within which members of society can plan their own actions. The most obvious effect is that no one can predict what social results judges will turn out to prefer in the future, leaving even the most clearly written laws surrounded by a fog of uncertainty that invites increased litigation. The opposite of the results-oriented judge is the judge who will rule in favor of litigants that the judge may personally despise if the law is on that side in that case. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, for example, voted in favor of Benjamin Gitlow in the 1925 case of Gitlow v. New York, and then said afterwards, in a letter to Harold Lasky, that he had just voted for the right of an ass to drool about proletarian dictatorship. Likewise, Holmes dissented in Abrams v. United States in favor of appellants whose views he characterized in his judicial opinion itself as a creed that I believe to be the creed of ignorance and immaturity. As he told Lasky, "I loathed most of the things in favor of which I decided." Conversely, he could rule against litigants he personally viewed favorably. In another letter to Lasky, Holmes said that he had to write a decision against a very thorough and really well-expressed argument by two colored men, one very black, that even in intonations was better than, I should say, the majority of white discourses that we hear. Holmes was not taking sides or seeking results, but applying the law. Race and ethnicity. Older Budweiser. Back in the days of the Habsburg Empire, there was a town in Bohemia called Budweis. The people in that town were called Budweisers, and the town had a brewery which produced beer with the same name, but different from the American Budweiser. Like many communities in Bohemia during that era, Budweis had people of both Czech and German ancestries, speaking different languages, though many were also bilingual. They got along pretty well, and most people there thought of themselves as Budweisers, rather than as Czechs or Germans. But that would later change, for the worse, not only in Budweis, but throughout Bohemia. The mayor of Budweis spoke both Czech and German, but refused to be classified as a member of either group. His point was that we are all Budweisers. As with virtually all groups in virtually all countries and in virtually all eras, there were differences between the Germans and the Czechs in Budweis. Germans were more educated, more prosperous, and more prominent in business and the professions. The German language at that point had a much wider and richer literature, the Slavic languages having acquired written versions centuries later than the languages of Western Europe. Educated Bohemians of whatever ethnicity were usually educated in German. Those Czechs who wished to rise into the upper echelons, whether in business, the military, or the professions, had to master the German language and culture in order to fit in with those already at the higher levels. People on both sides learned to live with this situation, and Czechs were welcomed into the German cultural enclaves in Bohemia, where they mastered that culture. In Budweiss, they could all be Budweisers. As in so many other countries, and in so many other times, the rise of a newly educated intellectual class in the 19th century polarized the society with ethnic identity politics. All over Bohemia, the new Czech intelligentsia urged Czechs to think of themselves as Czechs, not Bohemians or Budweisers or anything else that would transcend their ethnic identity. Demands were made that street signs in Prague, which had been in both Czech and German before, now be exclusively in Czech. Quotas were demanded for a certain percentage of Czech music to be played by the Budweiser Orchestra. If such demands seem petty, their consequences were not small. People of German ancestry resisted ethnic classifications, but the Czech intelligentsia insisted, and Czech politicians went along with the trend on many issues, large and small. Eventually, Germans as well began in self-defense to think of themselves as Germans, rather than as Bohemians or Budweisers, and to defend their interests as Germans. This ethnic polarization in the 19th century was a fateful step whose full consequences have not yet ended completely, even in the 21st century. A crucial turning point was the creation of the new nation of Czechoslovakia when the Habsburg Empire was broken up after the First World War. Czech leaders declared the new nation's mission to include a correction of social injustice so as to put right the historic wrongs of the 17th century. What were those wrongs? Czech nobles who revolted against the Habsburg Empire back in the 17th century were defeated and had their lands confiscated and turned over to Germans. Presumably, no one from the 17th century was still alive when Czechoslovakia was created in the 20th century, but Czech nationalists kept the grievance alive, as ethnic identity ideologues have done in countries around the world. Government policies designed to undo history with preferential treatment for Czechs polarized the existing generation of Germans and Czechs. Bitter German reactions led eventually to demands that the part of the country where they lived be united with neighboring Germany. From this came the Munich Crisis of 1938 that dismembered Czechoslovakia on the eve of World War II. When the Nazis conquered the whole country, the Germans now lorded it over the Czechs. After the war, the Czech reaction led to mass expulsions of Germans under brutal conditions that cost many lives. Today, refugees in Germany are still demanding restitution. If only the grievances of past centuries had been left in the past. If only they had all remained Budweisers or Bohemians. Diversity in India. If facts carried some weight with those who are politically correct, the recent outbreak of savage and lethal violence in India's state of Gujarat might cause some reassessments of both India and diversity. This is only the latest round in a cycle of violence and revenge between the Hindus and the Muslims in that country. The death toll has reached 489 people in a few days. That includes the Hindu activists who were firebombed while on a train returning from the site of a razed mosque, where they planned to build a Hindu temple, and many Muslims then slaughtered by Indian mobs in retaliation. These mobs have burned Muslim women and children alive in their homes. Nor is such savagery new in India, or limited to clashes between Hindus and Muslims. At other times and places, it has been one caste against another, locals versus outsiders, or the stormtrooper organization Shiv Sena against anybody who gets in their way. In some places, thugs resentful of Western influence attack shops that sell Valentine cards. None of this fits the pious picture of peaceful and spiritual India that so captivates many Americans. India has served as one of the foreign Edens to which those Americans turn in order to show their disdain for the United States. At one time, the Soviet Union played that role, then China, then Cuba, and for some, India. What happens in the real India doesn't matter. It is the symbolic India of their dreams to which they impute all the virtues they declare to be lacking in the USA. It is not India's fault that we have some fatuous Americans who want to put Indians up on a pedestal in order to score points against their fellow Americans. But we need to be aware of the truth as well. Those who are constantly gushing about the supposed benefits of diversity never want to put their beliefs to the test of looking at the facts about countries where people are divided by language, culture, religion, and in other ways, such as caste in India. Such countries are all too often riddled with strife and violence. India is one of the most diverse nations on earth. No more than one-third of its people speak any given language, and the population is divided innumerable ways by caste, ethnicity, religion, and numerous localisms. Lethal riots have marked its history from the beginning. When India gained its independence in 1947, the number of Hindus and Muslims who killed each other in one year exceeded the total number of blacks lynched in the entire history of the United States. Yet we are told that we should be like those gentle people, as if India were a nation of Gandhis. In reality, Gandhi was assassinated for trying to stop internecine strife in India. If there is no need to impute wholly unrealistic sainthood to India, there is also no need to single it out for demonization. Many other countries with the much-touted diversity have likewise been racked by internal slaughters and atrocities. Only about 20 miles away from India, the island nation of Sri Lanka has suffered more deaths among its majority and minority populations as a result of internal strife and civil war than the much larger United States suffered during the Vietnam War. Other such diverse countries as Rwanda and those in the Balkans have a similar catalog of horrors. Diversity is not just a matter of demographics. It is also a matter of identity and identity politics. Sri Lanka was one of the most peaceful nations on earth before demagogues began hyping identity and demanding group preferences and quotas back in the 1950s. Demographically, the United States has always been diverse, having received immigrants from all over the world. However, until recent times, it was understood by all that they came here to become Americans, not to remain foreign. By the second generation, most were speaking English, and by the third generation, they were speaking only English. Today, however, our citizen of the world types are doing all they can to keep foreigners foreign and domestic minorities riled up over grievances, past and present, real and imaginary. Above all, they want group identity and group preferences and quotas. In short, they want all the things that have brought on the kinds of disasters from which India and other such diverse countries have suffered grievously. The slavery card. One of the many sad signs of our times is that people are not only playing the race card, they are playing the slavery card, which is supposedly the biggest trump of all. At the so-called Million Man March in Washington, poet Maya Angelou rang all the changes on slavery, at a rally billed as forward-looking and as being about black independence rather than white guilt. Meanwhile, best-selling author Dinesh D'Souza was being denounced in the media for having said that slavery was not a racist institution. First of all, anyone familiar with the history of slavery around the world knows that its origins go back thousands of years and that slaves and slave owners were very often of the same race. Those who are ignorant of all this, or who think of slavery in the United States as if it were the only slavery, go ballistic when anyone tells them that this institution was not based on race. Blacks were not enslaved because they were black, but because they were available at the time. Whites enslaved other whites in Europe for centuries before the first black slave was brought to the Western Hemisphere. Only late in history were human beings even capable of crossing an ocean to get millions of other human beings of a different race. In the thousands of years before that, not only did Europeans enslave other Europeans, Asians enslaved other Asians, Africans enslaved other Africans, and the native peoples of the Western Hemisphere enslaved other native peoples of the Western Hemisphere. D'Souza was right. Slavery was not about race. The fact that his critics are ignorant of history is their problem. What was peculiar about the American situation was not just that slaves and slave owners were of different races, but that slavery contradicted the whole philosophy of freedom on which the society was founded. If all men were created equal, as the Declaration of Independence said, then blacks had to be depicted as less than men. While the antebellum South produced a huge volume of apologetic literature trying to justify slavery on racist grounds, no such justification was considered necessary in vast reaches of the world and over vast expanses of time. In most parts of the world, people saw nothing wrong with slavery. Strange as that seems to us today, 100 years ago, only Western civilization saw anything wrong with slavery. And 200 years ago, only a minority in the West thought it was wrong. Africans, Arabs, Asians, and others not only maintained slavery long after it was abolished throughout the Western Hemisphere, they resisted all attempts of the West to stamp out slavery in their lands during the Age of Imperialism. Only the fact that the West had greater firepower and more economic and political clout enabled them to impose the abolition of slavery, as they imposed other Western ideas on the non-Western world. Those who talk about slavery as if it were just the enslavement of blacks by whites ignore not only how widespread this institution was and how far back in history it went, they also ignore how recently slavery continued to exist outside of Western civilization. While slavery was destroyed in the West during the 19th century, the struggle to end slavery elsewhere continued well into the 20th century. And pockets of slavery still exist to this moment in Africa. But there is scarcely a peep about it from black leaders in America who thunder about slavery in the past. If slavery were the real issue, then slavery among flesh and blood human beings alive today would arouse far more outcry than past slavery among people who are long dead. The difference is that past slavery can be cashed in for political benefits today, while slavery in North Africa only distracts from these political goals. Worse yet, talking about slavery in Africa would undermine the whole picture of unique white guilt, requiring unending reparations. While the Western world was just as guilty as other civilizations when it came to enslaving people for thousands of years, it was unique only in finally deciding that the whole institution was immoral and should be ended. But this conclusion was by no means universal, even in the Western world, however obvious it may seem to us today. Thousands of free blacks owned slaves in the antebellum South, and years after the Emancipation Proclamation in the United States, whites as well as blacks were still being bought and sold as slaves in North Africa and the Middle East. Anyone who wants reparations based on history will have to gerrymander history very carefully. Otherwise, practically everybody would owe reparations to practically everybody else. Minorities. Years ago, when I was running a research project in Washington, a memorandum came down from on high, telling us that there was money available to hire minority professionals for the summer, without having to take it out of the regular project budget. "Wonderful," I said. "There's a Jewish lady up at Princeton who wants to come down here and help me out, but I don't have any money to pay her." This idea was shot down immediately. "Jews are not a minority," I was told, "and Jews from Princeton are definitely not a minority." It did no good to point out that Jews are only 3% of the population, and so must be a minority. Nor did it do any good to say that Jews were defined as an ethnic minority in the research project itself. The powers that be turned a deaf ear to all such arguments. In a sense, they were right. The word minority had already become one of the many politically corrupted words. It no longer meant a statistically smaller part of the population. It meant people you feel sorry for. After all their achievements, nobody felt sorry for Jews anymore. Therefore, they were not a minority. Nobody feels sorry for Asian Americans anymore, after so many success stories. Therefore, they are increasingly excluded from minority status in programs and policies at some colleges and universities. A few years ago, a memorandum from the U.S. Air Force Academy gave lower cutoff scores for minority applicants being recruited, but Asian Americans had to meet the same standards as whites. Few institutions are so impolitic as to put such policies in writing, or so unfortunate as to have them leak out. But there is growing evidence that this practice extends well beyond the Air Force Academy. When Berkeley used verbal test score cutoffs to eliminate applicants in 1984 and 1986, minority students were exempted, but Asian American students were not. Many Asians were wiped out by the verbal cutoff scores because their strong suit tends to be math. At Harvard, the test scores of Asian American applicants were virtually the same as those of white applicants, but the Asian Americans actually admitted had test scores substantially higher than those of whites who were admitted. In terms of test scores, Asians had to be better to get in. It is not just Asians and Jews who lose their minority status because of outstanding performance. Some financial aid programs have also passed over those blacks who score above a certain level, in favor of those blacks who did poorly, who really need help. They want people they can feel sorry for. Academic smoothies are never at a loss to explain away whatever they do. At MIT, for example, the director of admissions has responded to criticisms of large test score disparities among people admitted from different racial and sex backgrounds by downgrading the importance of test scores. Differences in test scores have only a modest correlation with later academic performance, he said. This familiar argument is clever but phony. The average MIT student scores in the top 1% in math. Just where in that top 1% probably doesn't matter a lot, as the director of admissions says, but it does matter that he is in the top 1%. By the same token, the difference of a few million dollars between one Rockefeller and another probably doesn't matter that much, but that doesn't mean that it makes no difference how much money you have. It makes a very real difference that 90% of the white MIT students score higher in math than the average black MIT student. A substantially higher percentage of the black students fail to finish MIT, and those who do graduate have substantially lower grade point averages. The tragedy is that this waste, more than one-fourth of the black students don't graduate at MIT, is completely unnecessary. The average black student at MIT is well above the national average on math tests. He is just not in the stratospheric level of other MIT students. At most colleges, universities, or technical institutes, these same black students would be on the dean's list. In short, black students with every prospect of success are artificially turned into failures by being mismatched with their college. This is not peculiar to MIT. It is a nationwide phenomenon among elite schools who are more interested in having a good-looking body count from every group than they are in the price that has to be paid. Everyone pays a very high price for this academic fad. Disadvantaged minority students pay the highest price of all. Asians may be lucky that they are not considered a minority. Race, romance, and reality.
During one of the ghetto riots of the 1960s, my brother was out in the streets asking the rioters,
"Where are you going to shop after you burn down this man's store?" Although a riot is not the best place for a Socratic dialogue, my brother somehow returned home safely. Today, more than 30 years later, no one has yet answered his question. Reality, however, has answered it decisively and painfully. Low-income and minority neighborhoods across the country are sadly lacking in stores, and the stores they have charge higher prices for substandard goods sold in dirtier surroundings by less polite clerks and owners. The title of a study by the New York City Department of Consumer Affairs, "The Poor Pay More for Less," summed it up. Some residents of low-income areas have to go far from where they live to shop in more upscale neighborhoods and pay for a ride back home with their groceries. An organization for the elderly in some Upper Manhattan low-income neighborhoods has arranged for bus trips to New Jersey for them to do their shopping. It was not like this when I grew up in Harlem in the 1940s. It was less than half a block to a drugstore, no more than half a block to a grocery store, and there was a supermarket across the street from that store. You didn't have to go two blocks to find a butcher shop or a stationery store or an optician. There was a dentist across the street. I can't remember any of these people being rude to me when I was a kid. There were too many alternatives around for that. There was not enough difference in prices to make it worth spending a nickel to ride a subway to another neighborhood for shopping. People who live in low-income and minority neighborhoods today are still paying the price for the riots of the past, as well as numerous other counterproductive social trends that began in the 1960s. The same romanticism that turned mob violence and looting into an uprising of the oppressed still insists on seeing the problems of these neighborhoods in similar terms. When black economist Walter Williams wrote an article explaining the higher costs behind higher prices in ghetto stores a quarter of a century ago, he was denounced as a white racist by people who obviously had never seen him. The politically acceptable reasons for higher prices were racism and exploitation. But it was hard for an economist to reconcile exploitation with stores closing down and leaving neighborhoods where they were supposedly making big bucks off the locals. The armies of community activists and other professional protesters spawned by the Great Society programs of the 1960s are fierce in their indignation at the lack of stores in ghetto neighborhoods. Among the many things they blame are never community activists and the romantic vision of victimhood and resentment that they spawn. My first glimpse of that vision came at Cornell University back in the late 60s as I passed a group of black students in the hall near my office. They had just come from a class on ghetto economic problems taught by the local radical guru. "How are we going to get those Jews out of Harlem?" one of the students bitterly asked. They seemed unreceptive to my question as to whom they planned to replace them with. Nor was it an easy question. It hasn't really been answered to this day. What is an even tougher question to deal with is, how do you explain why black communities across the country were seldom served by black grocers or other storekeepers? The stark choices seem to be to blame the victim or to blame society or some other group. In reality, there is nothing at all unusual about situations where the businesses in a given community are run predominantly by people who are not part of that community. It was common for generations for the entrepreneurial Chinese to be the predominant businessmen in communities of Malays, Indonesians, Vietnamese, and others in Southeast Asia. So were the Jews among the Slavs in Eastern Europe, the Lebanese among the people of Sierra Leone, and other similar groups in countries around the world. There are far too many interwoven historical, cultural, and economic strands to try to disentangle to explain why any given group at any given juncture is where it is. What we can do is save the romantic hogwash. Its price is too high, much like the price of groceries in the ghetto. Dog in the Manger Politics. A plastic surgeon of Chinese ancestry in Sydney, Australia, may not sound like an average individual, but the moral of his story is all too common in countries around the world. Born in Malaysia, this plastic surgeon was in one of many high-level positions occupied by the Chinese minority and coveted by the Malay majority. Moreover, under the country's affirmative action policies, he understood that his days as a plastic surgeon were numbered. He took it all without bitterness, offering to stay on to treat disfigured children and others until a Malay plastic surgeon was available to replace him. But he missed the point. They wanted him out of there, whether or not there was a Malay to replace him, and whether or not disfigured people had anyone else to turn to. The surgeon relocated to Australia, where he was apparently doing quite well by the time I encountered him. The real victims of the Malaysian government's policies were still in Malaysia. This dog-in-the-manger approach is by no means peculiar to Malaysia. Envy of others' success and embarrassment at being visibly unable to match their performance have been political driving forces behind many programs of preferences and quotas. When Romania acquired additional territory from the defeated Central Powers after the First World War, it also acquired universities which were culturally either German or Hungarian. One of their top priorities was to get rid of the Germans and the Hungarians on the faculties and transform the universities into Romanian bastions. At that point, roughly three-quarters of all Romanians were still illiterate, so replacing these foreign professors with Romanians of comparable caliber was very unlikely. But replacement was not the issue. Getting rid of those who were better qualified was the issue. Despite all the zeal expended in converting German and Hungarian universities in the new provinces of Bukovina and Transylvania into Romanian universities,
there was no urgency at all about creating a university in the province of Bessarabia,
where none existed. Moreover, when Hungarian students living in Romania began going to Hungary to attend universities there, the Romanian government forbade them to do so. What is involved is not just envy. It is the threat to one's ego that is crucial in promoting dog-in-the-manger policies. When Nigeria became an independent nation back in the 1960s, many of the educated, skilled business and professional people in northern Nigeria were from tribes in southern Nigeria. One of the top priorities of northern Nigerian politicians was to get rid of such people. The hope was to replace them eventually with northern Nigerians. But in the meantime, the northern Nigerians wanted them out of there, even if they had to hire Europeans to replace them or suffer a deterioration of the services being performed by the southern Nigerians. Having Europeans in these occupations was far less of a threat to the ego than having fellow Africans so dramatically outperforming the locals. Such attitudes are not unknown in the United States, whether or not ethnic or racial differences are involved. The same dog in the manger can be found when the issue is class. Liberals have never ceased denouncing Ronald Reagan's tax cuts for the rich in the early 1980s, despite the actual results, including a record-breaking period of economic expansion. After the tax rate was cut on the highest income brackets and on others, not only did the total tax receipts rise, but the percentage of those receipts paid by the rich also rose. Why then were the liberals unhappy? Because those in the upper brackets paid these vastly greater taxes out of rising incomes, while retaining a higher percentage of those incomes for themselves. The dog-in-the-manger principle requires that the rich be made worse off. Any policy that fails to do that has failed politically, regardless of what economic benefits it may bring to the society as a whole. While such attitudes are sufficiently widespread around the world that they cannot be attributed to a particular culture, neither are they inevitable. Very often, the key ingredient in the rise of explosive resentments is the rise of an intelligentsia preoccupied with invidious comparisons rather than general well-being. Ironically, all too often, the rich themselves have been the patrons of such intellectuals, whether at the universities, the foundations, or other institutions supported by their donations. Friends of Blacks. Who was it who said, "If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall"? Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, Charles Murray? Not even close. It was Frederick Douglass. This was part of a speech in which Douglass also said, "Everybody has asked the question, what shall we do with the Negro? I have had but one answer from the beginning. Do nothing with us. Your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. Do nothing with us." Frederick Douglass had achieved a deeper understanding in the 19th century than any of the black leaders of today. Those whites who feel a need to do something with blacks and for blacks have been some of the most dangerous friends of blacks. Academia is the home of many such friends, which is why there are not only double standards of admissions to colleges, but also in some places double standards in grading. The late David Reisman called it affirmative grading. A professor at one of California's state universities, where black students are allowed to graduate on the basis of easier standards, put it bluntly, "We are just lying to these black students when we give them degrees." That lie is particularly deadly when the degree is a medical degree, authorizing someone to treat sick people or perform surgery on children.
For years, Dr. Patrick Chavis was held up as a shining example of the success of affirmative action, for he was admitted to medical school as a result of minority preferences and went back to the black community to practice medicine. In fact, he was publicly praised by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights just 2 weeks before his license was suspended after his patients died under conditions that brought the matter to the attention of the Medical Board of California. An administrative law judge referred to Chavis's inability to perform some of the most basic duties required of a physician. A year later, after a fuller investigation, his license was revoked. Those who had for years been using Chavis as a shining example of the success of affirmative action suddenly changed tactics and claimed that an isolated example of failure proved nothing. Sadly, Chavis was not an isolated example. When a professor at the Harvard Medical School declared publicly, back in the 1970s, that black students were being allowed to graduate from that institution without meeting the same standards as others, he was denounced as a racist for saying that it was cruel to allow trusting patients to pay for our irresponsibility, trusting black patients in many cases. Why do supposedly responsible people create such dangerous double standards? Some imagine that they are being friends to blacks by lowering the standards for them. Some don't think that blacks have what it takes to meet real standards and that colleges and universities will lose their diversity and perhaps federal money with it if they don't lower the standards in order to get an acceptable racial body count. My own experience as a teacher was that black students would meet higher standards if you refused to lower the standards for them. This was not the royal road to popularity, either with the students themselves or with the friends of blacks on the faculty and in the administration. But when the dust finally settled, the students met the standards. We have gotten so used to abysmal performances from black students, beginning in failing ghetto schools, that it is hard for some to believe that black students once did a lot better than they do today, at least in places and times with good schools. As far back as the First World War, black soldiers from New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Ohio scored higher on mental tests than white soldiers from Georgia, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Mississippi. During the 1940s, black students in Harlem schools had test scores very similar to those of white working-class students on the Lower East Side of New York. Sometimes the Harlem scores were a little higher or a little lower, but they were never miles behind, the way they are today in many ghetto schools. If blacks could do better back when their opportunities were worse, why can't today's ghetto students do better? Perhaps blacks have too many friends today. Giving business the business. Television characters like J.R. Ewing in Dallas may have portrayed businessmen as Machiavellian devils, but in some respects at least, businessmen seem much more likely to be patsies than predators. For years now, the Capital Research Center in Washington has been documenting how corporate America has been bankrolling all sorts of left-leaning groups whose programs attack or undermine the free market in general and big corporations in particular. When developers subsidize environmental extremists and employers contribute money to groups seeking to have government deny those employers the right to hire whatever individuals can do the job best, then something very strange is going on. An even stranger and perhaps more dangerous development has been the hiring of so-called diversity consultants by big-name corporations all across the country. These diversity consultants will come in to harangue your employees with the latest trendy notions on race and ethnicity, or they will arrange weekend retreats where they can browbeat the staff and management. They put out brochures, videotapes, newsletters, or anything else that will send out the word and bring in the money. These professional intimidators don't come cheap. The more skilled or brazen of them charge thousands of dollars per day, and many will not work by the day, but insist on a long-term contract. What are their skills? What are their credentials? What benefits can they promise? Their skills are considerable. They have been known to reduce some employees to tears with their badgering, sneers, and insinuations, just as they have been known to reduce some college students to tears when they take their act onto the campus. They are great at laying on guilt trips or getting personal in a nasty way. Often they treat adults like children or like guinea pigs. Sometimes they ask the employees to line up and those who are religious to step to the right, those who believe that they are not racists to step forward, and so on. Above all, the diversity types do not discuss on the same plane with others. They lay down the social dogma from on high. Credentials? Merely asking such a question is like asking to be accused of insensitivity, if not racism. There are no formal credentials required to be known as a diversity consultant. Effrontery and gall are pretty much the essentials. They are the secular versions of Elmer Gantry. What benefits do they promise to employers? Usually nothing tangible that you can see anytime soon. That would be simplistic and not very profitable to the consultants. The relationship between employees of different racial and ethnic backgrounds is supposed to be a great mystery whose unraveling will require much time and much re-education. Black and white employees who were watching the same TV programs at home the previous night and perhaps eating the same junk food at the mall during lunchtime, are taught to think of each other as exotic creatures from different worlds, unable to understand each other except with the painful and expensive help of diversity consultants. How did businesses, or the country, manage to keep from coming apart all those years before these secular messiahs arrived on the scene? More important, why doesn't someone demand that they put up or shut up? Have businesses or colleges that go in for this kind of bombast had happier relations among the various racial, ethnic, or other groups afterwards? Or is it always too early to see results yet? In academia, the results seem to be that colleges which go in for this kind of brainwashing have more intergroup strife than before and more than colleges where no such programs exist. Businesses that persist in subjecting their employees to this kind of indignity may see lawsuits for stress before they see any tangible benefits. As one who deplores the litigation explosion, I nevertheless think a few multi-million-dollar damage awards would be a very healthy thing to help restore sanity and common decency where these qualities are currently taking a back seat to being on the side of the politically correct angels. Both the patterns of corporate philanthropy to their political enemies and the susceptibility of corporate management to such unproven nostrums as diversity consultants may suggest a death wish to the more psychologically inclined. A more rationalistic explanation might be that it is all for the sake of public relations, even if the top corporate executives themselves think it is bunk. Whatever the explanation, it is bad business in the long run. Not only for business itself, but for this country. Stereotypes versus the market. There is much loose talk about stereotypes these days. Often, it makes me think back to an episode many years ago. Back during the Korean War, a young Marine named Albert Gruner graduated from the photography school at Pensacola Naval Air Station and was ordered to report for duty as a photographer at the photo lab at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Yet, when he arrived at Camp Lejeune, he discovered that his orders had been changed.
He was now told to report instead to the supply depot, where he was assigned to handle photographic supplies. Baffled and disappointed by the sudden change, Gruner told me his story, and was further taken aback when I burst out laughing. In reality, I was part of the reason for his misfortune. Some months earlier, the photo lab received its first group of graduates from the photography school at the Pensacola Naval Air Station. By and large, we were better photographers than those they had. However, we were also young draftees with attitudes wholly different from those of career Marines. We saw the Marine Corps as just an unwelcome interlude in our lives, and we were less than awed by our superiors or by their rules or orders. We hung out together and became known, not always affectionately, as the Pensacola Gang. When the captain in charge of the photo lab had had about as much of us as he could stand, he cleaned out the lot of us, breaking up the Pensacola Gang and scattering us individually to various other places around the base. When he later received word that another photographer from Pensacola had been assigned to his lab, the captain had him transferred sight unseen. It so happened that Gruner was a different sort of fellow and would probably have gotten along very well in the photo lab, but he never got the chance because of the behavior of his predecessors. Today, that would be called stereotyping, and the captain would be criticized for not judging Gruner as an individual. However, whatever the merits of that argument in this particular case, no one goes around judging everyone as an individual, however popular such cant may be. When you are walking down a dark street at night and see a shadowy figure in an alley up ahead, do you judge him as an individual, or do you cross the street and pass on the opposite side? Judging him as an individual could cost you your life. It may turn out that he is just a kindly neighbor out walking his dog, but you discover that only after the fact. The high cost of knowledge is often overlooked when discussing social policies, and especially social policies in the emotionally charged area of race and ethnicity. In real life, decisions are based on imperfect knowledge, simply because there is no other kind. Recently, a black middle-class professional wrote of his resentment when he was asked to pay for his meal in advance in an Asian-owned restaurant, especially after he noted that a white couple that came in was not asked to do the same. Was this arbitrary racism or self-protection based on experience in this neighborhood? That was the key question he did not ask, nor do most journalistic stories or even scholarly studies. The same man also expressed resentment at the looks of aversion he received from fellow blacks in another establishment because he was wearing his hair in dreadlocks. Clearly, this was not a question of racism, but of repugnance toward the kind of people who make a statement with that kind of hairstyle. Apparently, neither blacks, whites, nor Asians judge each person as an individual. Probably no one else in the world does either, though the intelligentsia may talk that way. Fortunately, the marketplace puts a price on incorrect generalizations, as it does on all sorts of other incorrect assumptions behind economic decisions. Even the most racist owner of a professional basketball team could not refuse to hire blacks unless he were willing to face bankruptcy and thereby cease to be a basketball owner. Theoretically, racists could simply absorb the losses created by their own discrimination. Empirically, it is very hard to find people who are willing to lose hard cash in order to discriminate. Racists may prefer their own group to others, but they prefer themselves most of all. That is